And this evening, we've also got a special evening. We've got three shorter talks, three people, Maitri Varsin, Moksha Tara, and a guest speaker called Parag are going to speak to us about some of the mind training slogans. So I'll say a little bit to just introduce the theme of mind training for you and the slogans to create some context. But before I do that, I just wanted to introduce you to Parag, who's going to be the third of our guest speakers. So I'm really pleased, really delighted we've got Parag just here in Sheffield for a few days. Parag works at Padmaloka, lives and works at Padmaloka, which is a retreat centre for men. And it's where the ordination team are based. And Parag is a member of the ordination team who help, basically dedicates his life with a team of other senior order members to help men train to join our order, to train for ordination. And Parag is spending a few days meeting up with some of the men in Sheffield who are training for ordination. And we're really lucky he's agreed to give us a talk as well this evening. I met Parag before that. He was the Mitra convener in Nottingham, and I got to know him a little bit then. Always enjoy Parag's company. There's something very kind of delightful and very real about Parag and his communication. And just to get, and before that, I don't know the exact chronology of his life, but he trained in fine art school at university. Did fine art degree, so he's an artist. With very kind of refined consciousness of an artist. At the same time, he was a member of a band who toured the United States, a garage punk band, and a death metal band. So he's a, as well as having this refined consciousness, there's a real heavy metal Dharma practitioner who's just really, you know, really full-on Dharma practitioner in a way, the kind of heavy metal, death metal Dharma practitioner and an artist. So, you know, both of those paradoxical things Parag contains, and yeah, we're really lucky to be hearing from him later. So just a brief introduction, you'll get a taste of him yourself when he speaks to us in a little while. But we're going to have three short talks, as I said, on the theme of mind training slogans. We've heard a lot about mind training over the last few months since January, and we were reminded last week, what we're training our mind in is the spiritual attitude of the Bodhisattva, the ideal Buddhist who is dedicated, obsessed with enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So we're training our mind and our hearts in that attitude, that spirit of the Bodhisattva. And mind training is a text that challenges us to suspend our usual way of seeing the world and to try and experiment with seeing through the eyes of a Bodhisattva. So some of the things it suggests may sound challenging or shocking even. So we've heard about some of the verses, gather all blame onto one, be grateful to everyone, see all dharmas as dreamlike. And we've had an urban retreat for a couple of weeks where we tried using the five forces to apply mind training in our daily life. Because mind training challenges us to turn the adversity and the difficulties of our everyday situations into an opportunity to practice, an opportunity to transform our emotions, to transform our minds. And then one of the things that mind training really, really uses is slogans. And there's a verse in the text that says, use slogans to train in all activities. We've had a taste, a flavour of some of these slogans already that I've mentioned. And there's a list towards the end of the text of some really cracking slogans, really helpful slogans that if you just tried to live according to the slogan, it would really massively change your life. So some examples, don't think about others' faults. Some very practical slogans, don't think about others' faults. Give up hope for results. Don't make a fuss. Don't be irritable. Don't be temperamental. So you can just get the sense of like a Bodhisattva just telling you how they see the world and how, you know, just think the things we need to let go of, the way we need to practice. So there's some really practical slogans. So we're going to hear just from three speakers about some slogans, a slogan that inspires them that they try to put into practice. So first of all, Maitri Varsin is going to, in a few moments, going to talk to us about a slogan which is don't expect thanks. And then Moksha Tara will speak to us about her slogan, which is don't compete. And then Parag finally will speak about work on your strongest disturbing emotion first. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about these slogans from these three great speakers, and firstly, Maestro Vasin.
Thank you. Is that all right? Yeah. Right. It's lovely seeing you all. It's not always my most comfortable place to be, this, but it's great to actually take the challenge and share my experience and view on the Dharma. So I chose this slogan, "Don't expect thanks." And in a way, we can expand on this. So it's not just thanks, it's things like approval, don't expect appreciation, don't expect praise, and something in return, basically. And I think, in many ways, some of the slogans we've talked about in previous weeks can be quite difficult to understand, but this is quite straightforward, I think. But one thing I'd like to say is that it's not about not thanking people. So, I certainly appreciate being thanked, and I'm certainly not suggesting we stop doing that. I'd like to thank our root teacher Sangharachita, the band Sangharachita, and everybody who's actually brought Triratna to where it is, because their efforts have really sort of given me the ability to have my life and have it where it is. To cut it short, it's in a very much better place than it used to be. So I'm definitely very thankful and very grateful to people who made this possible for me. So it's not about not thanking people and not being grateful and not appreciating people, but it's about not expecting something in return. And in a sense, we live in a culture, and I very much do experience life in a way where I expect something back. When I do something, I expect something back, whether it's conscious or not. And a lot of the time, we live in this reciprocal sort of relationship with each other. And that's the culture we quite often live in. And we think about things in terms of, well, what's in it for me? If I do this, what I get back? And I know I've sort of given a gift or given a donation or something, money away, and there's a part of me like, I really want somebody to notice this and know this, and I want to share it, I want to tell someone, just really become aware there's a part of me that wants some kind of appreciation for it, from some praise or something like that. And I think in a way, this is not necessarily a bad thing. This is like the culture that we live in, and I've come across where it says in a Buddhist view, this is like the foundation we need before we can sort of develop further. So we need this kind of society that there is a reciprocal relationship, there is enough stability, and if you think of the Buddha's days, there was enough food produced, there was enough peace, and enough appreciation of ethics and morality that people can full-time practice spirituality. So it's not a bad thing that we expect things back. But it is a limited sort of place to be. So if we live a life where everything we do it out of a sense of, I want something back. It's quite limiting, really. It's kind of, compared to our whole potential, it's very limiting. But it isn't necessarily a bad thing. It is like the mud the lotus grows out of. So I don't want to say this is a terrible, society in itself is bad, or we want to, like, everyone's going to go out and do things without any kind of expectation or anything bad. And most of the time, I realize I actually do, at some level, want something back. And in the sense, this, I like this slogan because it goes on, it really brings my mind to what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to aim at. This sense of being able to give things or do things out of a sense of not wanting something back. So one of the things that comes to my mind straight away is, we'll find out more about Ratnasambhava if you've not heard about this Buddha, and his gesture of open-ended generosity. So there's a gesture of open-ended generosity. And there's something really beautiful about this whole sense. And when I look at it, I usually get a sense, okay, I've got open-ended generosity is what I'm aspiring to, but a lot of the time, my other hand's going, give something back. And I don't want to be hard on myself or others in a way, but there is a limitation and ugliness in that. It's like, what I really want to do is just give open-handedly. And this comes from a place of abundance. So Ratnasambhava gives from a place of abundance. And it's not abundance in the sense of material wealth and stuff, it's an inner abundance. And this inner abundance is, for me, it really represents this sense of being sort of content and stable and rooted in my practice of ethics, in my practice of sangha, in a way, it's just sharing things and living for something bigger. And from that sort of sense, we get, at the times when I can be in touch with it, I get a sense of just wanting to give freely. Really wanted to give freely, and it's a really, really happy place to be, a really beautiful state of mind to exist in, that way of being, way of living. So I really aspire to want to live from this place. But it's not an easy thing to do. And in a way, like Buddhist ethics and worldly ethics, they can look very similar a lot of the time. But I'd like to sort of separate it in my mind about like, in a way, it's like being nice and being kind. You know, they sound very similar, but I'd say if we want something back, that's kind of like living in a being nice world, where I'll be nice if you're nice back to me, and I'll help you if you help me, and this sort of sense. And it's okay. It's a good foundation. It's a good foundation. But I really want to move to being able to do it from unconditioned sort of giving, from a sense of abundance. And Buddhist ethics is about practicing in a way so we can go to a place where we're not being kind, where we're not being nice, and we're not being sort of moral in a way, because we want something back in response. It's because of its own sake, because actually virtuous acts and deeds are actually beautiful in themselves, and you know, it's a wonderful place to live in, wonderful states of mind to dwell in. So I really like this very pithy, very sort of short slogan, and it just really, really expands into, in many ways, the heart of Buddhist practice. Just a very short slogan. So I was also thinking, I have a few examples. I was thinking, like the first time I realized I wasn't kind of giving things unconditionally, was at this Buddhist center, and I was living in the community. I went downstairs, and there was somebody who's not here anymore, so they're not in this room. And I won't give a name anyway, but yeah, he was a difficult customer. Four-stage quite often, but so I came down one morning, and I said good morning to him. And then he just turned his back and just, you know, he did this sort of thing. And then I realized about 20 minutes, half an hour later, that I spent all this time just really chuntering away in my head, just this papancha, this all this ill will that arose, and blah, 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 just really going in my head, just feeling really like strange and ugly and kind of unpleasant. And I just realized that me saying good morning to him wasn't unconditional. Mm-hmm. I could just really see, oh, that's where I went wrong. I didn't just do it out of a sense of being kind and just being unconditionally saying good morning. I wanted something back. I wanted him to acknowledge that I'd said something and give me something back. And that was the beginning when I realized, oh, okay. So subconsciously, quite often I do things, and there's a part of me just wants something back. And that part of me limits me, basically. It's getting into a give and take and what's in it for me kind of relationship, and I want to break out from that. And there's something about talking, public talking, and the more I've looked into it for myself, it's something I find quite difficult or quite challenging in a way. And a lot of the time, it's about me wanting some kind of approval or praise or some sort of, yeah, just wanted to give an amazing talk, or, you know, just get all these things built up. And I know it's not you, because I know a lot of people here. I know fairly well a lot of people, and most of the time you're all very nice people. So I know it's not you guys, and it's kind of all rooted in my sort of my ego attachment and myself and wanting to sort of get approval and get set things. And the more I can relax about that, the more I can let go of that. Actually, it's a lovely thing to share the Dharma together. Yeah, it's a lovely thing to be able to do. And another thing. So for the first days I started coming here, I volunteered here, and I really enjoyed it. I got loads of energy. I'd spend, you know, 10, 12 hours a day for maybe 4 days a week just cleaning the center, just doing everything I can. And it was really, really great. And I, looking back at it, I could see that I was just doing out of just giving, just not really wanting anything back, not even thinking in those terms. And then things changed, and I needed to earn some money and get a job, sort of thing. And then it came up that I could get supported by the centre. So I moved into a position where I was supported by the centre to do what I was doing. And suddenly I started feeling quite tired. And it's really weird. And it's just when I look back, I can see that in my mind, it turned into a reciprocal relationship. So I was cleaning because I was getting paid. And it wasn't the case in a way. It was not why I was getting supported. But in my mind, it turned into this. And that just took away a lot of the energy, a lot of the pleasure of doing it. And Badania quite often jokes about stopping supporting me if I want to enjoy it again. But, I think we've got to be realistic as well. I don't need to live in the world as well. And so, yeah. I've just had my time, so I'll cut it short. But I can say another example that I catch myself quite often wanting something back is when I'm driving. So when I'm driving, I let somebody in, I do something nice, and my eyes straight away go to their hands. Are they going to thank me? Are they going to say thank? And if they don't, it will sort of straight away arises. You know, it's just like, I can just see, it's not out of kindness way, it's just like, oh, I'll give way to you as long as you appreciate that, that's what I've just done. And it's an ugly place to be in a way. It's just not as beautiful as just being kind, just being coming from abundance and being kind. And not expecting thanks in a way, it's really sums all these things up for me. It's kind of just saying, oh, I'm expecting something back, and just the more I can work with that, the more I can free myself from that expectation. It's absolutely great. I think I'll leave it here in that sense that this slogan is just pithy slogan just really reminds me, it helps me remind me of the whole aim of Buddhism and all the aim of Buddhist people. What we're doing is move towards enlightenment, moving towards going out of ourselves and becoming more selfless and just transcending the whole thing. So it's a very simple way of remembering what my life is about. Thank you.
So my slogan is don't compete. Don't compete. And I chose this slogan because I'm the best at not competing. So I thought I'd be like the best person to tell you about how not to compete. That might not be true. So actually I'm going to stand here and admit to being fiercely competitive, which isn't an easy thing to admit to because it's not, we were talking about ugliness, and I think sometimes competition can be quite ugly. But I am fiercely competitive in different ways, and I've got some examples of when I was young, like very, very little, when I was competitive, and just to give you a flavour of this. So there was a game called Dizzy Dinosaur. Great. So you had a wind-up dinosaur, and every now and then you had to set off the wind-up dinosaur, and it would go around the board game and knock over your pieces, and if your pieces got knocked over, you had to go back to the beginning. And my sister really likes telling this story about the time that I threw the Dizzy Dinosaur across the room in rage because it had knocked over my pieces. So that's one example. At primary school, we had some pencils in the corner, and every now and then we were told that we had to go and get the pencils. You know how some pencils are like HB pencils, and they're quite kind of, they're the best. The other pencils are like soft pencils, and they're like what the really tiny kids use. So whenever we were told to go and get a pencil, I'd run as fast as I could across the room, grab the HB pencil, and then do a little dance. A dance of joy and gladness that I'd beat everybody else to get the best pencil. I remember that very vividly. And another primary school example was sports day, maybe year six, probably like the last year of primary school. And Mandy Dexter broke her arm before sports day, so she couldn't be in sports day. And I knew that that would mean that I would win everything. And I was so happy. I was like, Mandy's broken her arm, I'm going to win, I'm even going to beat the boys. And I did. That's a bit of my conditioning. So yeah, it feels good to win. I feel good when I win, you know? And I was watching this this program with my mum called Child Genius, and it was these really, really smart kids who could spell words that you'd never heard of and do anagrams with words that you could never know. And this 10-year-old kid just said, when they were asking if they thought he would win, he just said, oh, I really hope that I will win. I really like winning. I really like the glory. And I thought, that's such a good way of describing it. You know, kids can say things that are so kind of direct, can't they? And it was like, so there's glory. I feel glory within myself, but there's also the glory of everyone else when you're kind of on top. And everyone's like, yeah. So yeah, being the best, winning, this is something that I find quite attractive. And I think it's quite primal, like, you know, like Gladiators, the TV program, but also kind of the original Gladiators, you know, where you'd be watching these guys compete and, you know, being the best gladiator, the one that couldn't be defeated. And I don't know, there's something that's quite kind of, we can be quite drawn to competition, can't we? There's all these, like, reality TV shows now as well that really thrive on competition. And like Game of Thrones, a TV series that's captured the imagination of many people. It's coming back soon. And again, there's a lot of competition in that program, like which family is going to end up on top. And we're kind of drawn to watching these things play out. And then in a more kind of, you know, grown up way, I think there are subtle social examples for me when competition kind of can come in. So that might be like with co-workers. I apologise and please forgive me if this comes in. Or with my friends, so like I might want the most praise at work. If other people are being praised, I'm like, I want my praise. Or with friends wanting to be like the coolest, the grooviest, the funniest. Now, these things can come in, and they're not pretty. I don't enjoy that aspect of competition in my life. And sometimes I think of it in terms of comparison, and this is something that we talk about in Buddhism as well, kind of where you try and figure out kind of who's better than who and who's worse than who and where are you in that scale. So yeah, it's all probably relatable, I hope. But yeah, this is why I chose the slogan, don't compete. It's because it's helped me to work with this personality trait maybe of being quite competitive. But if it feels good to win, if it does, and it often does for me, then what's the problem? Like, surely if you're feeling great and when you win, that's okay, then why would you not compete? So why are we being asked not to compete? And I mean, this example that I gave of Mandy Dexter is kind of a very good direct example of this. So in a way, competition can bring about a certain kind of joy or happiness at another person's suffering. So if there's a victory, there is also a defeat. And if you're looking always for the victory, then you're closing off from other people, or I'm closing off from other people, and I'm wanting other people to suffer in some way for my own gain. And there's a good line from the Dhammapada that illustrates this. It's victory begets hatred, for the defeated one experiences suffering. So yeah, winning comes with this kind of, there may be a personal gain in winning, but it's coming at the expense of other people. And I do experience that as a kind of a disconnection. It's destructive to my relationships at times. And if I'm in competition with other people, then those other people become my rival. And that kind of rivalry can lead to hatred. And Bhante Sangharakshita talks about the power mode versus the love mode. So the power mode is when you're denying the other person's existence or worth. And it's like when you're negating another person's existence. So this is what I don't want to do. I don't want to be going around negating other people's existences and living in the power mode. And the mind training slogans and this whole the whole kind of example of the Bodhisattva is looking to connect us more and more with other people. So more deeply with individuals, but also more broadly with as many people as possible. So that's why we're being asked in this slogan not to compete, is to experience the connection between myself and others. Um, Yeah, so if we're not going to compete, if we're going to experience the connection between ourselves and other people, what is the alternative? So how can we not compete? It's all very well just being told not to do something. And I've thought about two different ways in which I try to go beyond competition. And that's transforming the competitive urges and also transmuting the competitive urges, which I'll talk more about. So to transform competition, I'm talking about how I try to go from competition to connection. So the full quote from the Dharmapada is, "Victory begets hatred, for the defeated one experiences suffering. The tranquil one experiences happiness, giving up both victory and defeat." So the tranquil one experiences happiness, giving up both victory and defeat. So this word happiness is there. So I can compete if I want to. You know, if I want to carry on living this competitive kind of tendency out, then I can do, but I won't be happy if I do. So this slogan and that quote from Dharmapada is saying, if you're looking for happiness, don't compete. So I think I'm going to be happy if I win. That's why I want to win, is because it comes with this glory or whatever, and I think that's going to bring me happiness. But I notice that if I'm competing, actually, there's this rivalry, there's this disconnection, and I'm not happy. I'm much happier if I'm living out of friendship and connection. And this usually looks like appreciating other people rather than thinking that I've got to keep other people down to get myself on top. So I can look for happiness and tranquility in my experience if I'm able to transform competition into something like rejoicing in the merits of other people. So if I notice that somebody else has a quality or is achieving something that maybe I might even be noticing it because I'm feeling a bit of envy and a bit of competition. What I can try to do is rejoice in that person instead of feeling like I've got to get myself back on top. So this the connection that can come through that is more a deeper, more true happiness than the happiness that I might get if I manage to win here and there. So this is like the love mode that I said Sangharaksha talked about, the love mode and the power mode. So if I can affirm other people by rejoicing in them, looking to connect with gratitude for the, looking for gratitude for what they can offer. And within that process, I might be acknowledging the discomfort of that I want to be the best, and I might be thinking that I'm observing that somebody's better than me. But in a way, I'm looking to transcend this whole kind of framework of that there's people who are the best, there's people who are the worst, and trying to transform that into rejoicing in the merits of other people, appreciating the merits of other people, and seeing that those merits can be a source of inspiration for me as opposed to a source of envy or of competition. And this leads to an appreciation of the uniqueness of me and my friends. So it's like I might have some qualities that do benefit myself and other people, but my friends also have their own qualities that I can rejoice in. And we're not necessarily better one or the other. But also I can acknowledge that some people are particularly able to express themselves in ways that I aspire to maybe do myself, like whether that's kind of with spiritual qualities like kindness, like generosity, or if it's just like practical, like someone's a really good at reversing in their car, then I can just use that. So that's not so much kind of a spiritual quality, but so I can rejoice in these merits and look to kind of like use that as an aspiration or as an inspiration for myself, rather than thinking that I have to sometimes bring them down to so that I can kind of think that I'm better than them. Yeah. So that's transforming competition into rejoicing, into connection. So to transmute competition, that's when I'm saying that, I mean like using the energy that competition has and using it to transform it into, or to transmute it into something that's kind of more worthwhile or more beneficial. So our subtitle for this theme has been alchemy of the emotions. So in a way, this is like alchemy, like how can I use I am competitive to turn that into something that's kind of spiritual beneficial, put it in the service of growth, put it in the service of a spiritual breakthrough. So I'll just quickly talk about how games can be helpful here. So just kind of healthy games. It's a context for kind of my more primal urges of competition. But what I've noticed as I've grown older is that I can really commend the skills of the other people that I'm playing a game with, rather than kind of getting angry if I'm losing. And I really enjoy a really close game for that. You know, I'd much rather enjoy a close game of something like, I really like playing pool and lose, than I would play and like totally trash the opponent. So there's something about, honestly. We did go bowling once and that was just a little anomaly, but yeah, no, generally I try to rejoice in the other people's merits in games and just seeing that I can like to win, but I can also not be a bad loser and just really appreciate the skills of other people in games. And then also thinking about winning in terms of this word victory, I can think about having victory over my negative emotions. And in Buddhism, sometimes you might see forms of Buddhas that are wrathful, so they're kind of in flames and they're stomping and they're even kind of squishing beings beneath their feet. But this is to symbolize kind of squishing the negative emotions and transcending negative emotions. So again, using kind of the energy and power that competition can bring to overcome things like greed, hatred, and delusion in order to have spiritual breakthroughs. So I found that very inspiring. So how can I look at what is undermining within my practice? How can I look at what my values are and what are getting in the way of me living out my values? And if I want to destroy something, destroy those negative habits or negative emotions, and see that as a victory. And the Buddha came from a warrior clan, so I think he would have known quite a lot about kind of tribal wars and competition in that way, and tribal states. And again, in the Dhammapada, there are verses that indicate this. And that it indicates that he sees that the true victory can be over our own selfish, mean, and blind tendencies. So I also use that as a way to try to transmute my competitive urges. So I'm just going to end on a quote from the Dhammapada. Though one should conquer in battle thousands upon thousands of people, yet those who conquer themselves are truly the greatest in battle. It is indeed better to conquer oneself than to conquer other people.
Yes, hello Sheffield Sangha, my name is Pargo. Nice to see you all. Thanks Bodhinog for your introduction as well. So Bodhinog asked me if I choose one of the mind training slogans. For some reason I chose. what I wanted to choose, work on your strongest disturbing emotion first. Now I'm standing here in front of you all, I'm beginning to regret choosing that one, but we'll see what happens. What time is it? 12 minutes, okay. I've no idea if this is going to take 12 or 2 minutes, but we'll start. So work on your strongest disturbing emotion first. I think that's always stood out to me, just because I suppose I just don't want to live my life in the shadow of strong disturbing emotions. I just don't want to live my life in the sort of shadow of kind of deep, repetitive, grim, ugly habits. And I sort of figure that there's always going to be strong, disturbing emotions, and if I've committed my life to Dharma practice, well, that's going to have to be quite central to sort of look at that, as opposed to just committing my life to Dharma practice so that I can just be comfortable and just try and make the best job out of the messy situation that sort of samsara and conditioned existence anyway. I was trying to think what I said a bit louder then, didn't I? I won't do that again. So the first thing I thought I was thinking, well, what is my strongest disturbing emotion? And it wasn't very easy to find, actually. It sounds ridiculous because it's the strongest, most disturbing emotion you think it'd be. But I just realised it wasn't that obvious. And I had to kind of, it's almost like I'd step towards what I thought it was and it would kind of swim behind me. And it just seemed to kind of glide out of the way. But I figured that there was something about deep, deep habit and deep sort of particularly disturbing habit tending to hide. Disturbing emotion is something we don't want to experience. And most of us, well, all of us, me included, have spent our lives trying to organize, trying to find a constellation within conditioned existence where we can avoid deep disturbing emotions. I do it sort of all of the time, most of the time, I'd say. So there's a habit of sort of not noticing it in a way. I was also thinking that the less disturbing emotions, the more everyday disturbing emotions, are sort of, they're not so threatening, so they're not so hidden. And they're more sort of, easy to recognize in a way. And I also sort of thought, if you're aware of a disturbing emotion, it means you're hopefully you're in some creative relationship to it. So but the deeply disturbing emotions, I like this word, deeply disturbing. I just thought, it's the kind of real deal. It's, you're sort of really not messing around with this. It's not about, should I have more cake or not? It's something that, it's deep views that are probably screwing up your whole life anyway. So, cutting to the chase and enough kind of preamble. So I think my most strongest disturbing emotion is fear and dread. So that's kind of hopelessly vague, isn't it, for you? Yeah. But I think what I mean by that is I just don't know. I just really have a deep anxiety of living a meaningless life. I just don't want to live a meaningless life. I feel I've done it in the past, and I just don't want to do it again. So I don't want to have a pointless existence, because it's just whole. It's just whole. You probably all sort of assume you all sort of, we all know that having a life without meaning is just super crap, But the deeper fear is of repeatedly, we're told about sort of rebirth in Buddhism. My deepest fear is repeatedly going through what I went through in my earlier life, which wasn't particularly dramatic. It was just crap, But I just don't want to repeatedly be reborn and go through this sort of, this pointlessness and just thinking, this is just pointless. Why am I being, why is everyone just kind of off their head and me as well? It's just also sort of pointless. I'm glad you're all from here. But yeah, that's a particular fear of mine, is of just repeatedly. So, gosh, we're told if you don't practice the Dharma, if you don't gain its significant insight into the nature of reality and turn it around, then you're just going to come back and sort of have the same habits and stuff. And I just think, mass anxiety. I don't like the look of that. That's what the strongest disturbing emotion is. And it, manifests in all sorts of ways. Sort of how to work with this is in terms of slogan, how to approach it. I was just thinking of the way some of these slogans are phrased. So this idea of work on the deepest emotion, I thought, well, how do you work on it? What does it mean to work on it? And this thing of work on it first, I thought that was a bit, that doesn't quite make sense, because it's a bit like you've got a huge sink full of really dirty pans. One of them's got so much crud burnt into it, you're never going to clean it. So it's not like you really clean that one and get it out of the way and then you just sweep through the other pans. It's like, for me with this, it feels like it's not going to be first. It's going to be at the beginning, it's going to be in the middle, and it's going to be at the end. So it's, it just feels like it's just the phrasing of it, deal with the deepest one first. It's like, yeah, first and last and all of the time. And even just, the image of the Buddha, when he's gaining enlightenment, and what happens when Buddha's gaining enlightenment is you have the attack of Maya, you have this, these images of all these demons attacking the Buddha. So I find that so helpful, that image. It's a huge image in my sort of personal kind of myth, in a way, because it's like, even when you're that far from enlightenment, the emotions, the disturbing emotions are going to really go for it. So I just kind of like sort of remembering that. And as good as you get at Dharma practice, so to speak, there's always going to be a strongest what is it? A strongest disturbing emotion. And I don't think, you know, so that's always going to happen. There's always going to be this sort of polarity between, you know, your practice deepening and you know, the depth of strength of emotion you're going to have to deal with is going to sort of be even sort of deeper. I don't quite like the word emotion, actually, because it makes it just sound like just too psychological, which, you know, it's which is much more than that. I was also thinking that with something like this sort of deep, disturbing emotions, that I just have to play the long game with it. It would just have to play a long game. No sort of like quick, because I think if there's an anxious approach to quickly getting it out of the way, you're actually just in the grip of it. If there's a, if I sort this out, you know, I'm going to really go for refuge, and actually everything's just going to be all right, and I can kind of take my foot off the pedal. And so, you know, just trying to be aware of not trying to sort of deal with it so you can get it out of the way. To just to sort of have to play a long game with it. I think also with these huge, deep, even primal forces, which I think is what they're addressing in terms of deep, disturbing emotions, it's kind of deep primal forces that we've all got. You know, I feel sort of more animal than human quite a lot of the time. And I'm not just saying that, you know, I just feel like a dog sometimes, sniffing things, pissing, and just, I do just feel like that. I feel the amount of awareness I've actually got is quite limited. Why did I get onto that? Yeah, so I was thinking that that in terms of dealing with these deep primal forces, I've always felt that Dharma practice needs cunning and trickery. That, you know, I don't like using the term Mara because it can seem like something, oh, it's just Mara. And it's like, no, it's me, it's you. But so to speak, to use that terminology, it is like Mara or your deep habits. They're not just going to conform because you've gone for refuge and you've found the Buddhist center. They won't conform to that. They won't conform because you've got a white case and you're on the ordination team. You know, they're not interested in any of that. Deep primal forces, they're just there. They'll just trample all over that, and they do. So it needs cunning, trickery, patience, love, you know, faith, strong sort of commitment, faith in the three jewels, and mainly sort of help from others who know you well. I found help from sort of spiritual friends, but it's been absolutely just hugely important. And also being in relationship with friends that I can see are also engaging with their deep primal forces. So being in relationship with people, you can see that reflected in them, that they're doing the same thing. They're doing this mighty work. And particularly if they've got a lot more experience, or even a bit more experience, it's very easy for you to align with them. And that just, their work reflects your work, and it makes it so much easier for you to go through, because you're not doing it on your own, you know. That's part of Sangha, we're sort of doing it with each other, so to speak. All right, what next? I'm nearly finished. Maybe I'll say that bit at the end. I think I just want to develop an attitude of always being able to... I'm not seeing these things as psychological, I know I just said that. It just feels deep primal forces. Clashes, poisons, whatever you want to call them, deep primal forces that were, for me, it feels like they've been there lifetimes. So it's not just a psychological thing, but I feel like I really want to develop an attitude of always turning towards what's deepest and most sort of provocative to me and most sort of disturbing. And even developing a life where my Dharma practice thrives on being in relationship with these deep forces. Like there's an element of it that loves it, and I'm beginning to even see that a bit, and somehow some mysterious element of Dharma practice which really enjoys going right into the heavy stuff, not because I think I'm great or anything, but it's like there's part of the whole kind of myth of practice is partly something to do with just fearlessly moving into those very sort of strong areas, but that being reflected also in the fact that being reflected in what? just being reflected in the fact that your confidence and faith in the three jewels is really deepening and growing. But yeah, just I can't quite communicate it. Just that element of practice thriving on being in relationship to what's most sort of disturbing. There's a Milarepa, this sort of great Tibetan yogi from hundreds of years ago, and his enlightened yogi. One of his songs was, the more despair, the present, the more joy I feel. So he had this sort of sense of really seeing these sort of deep forces as just seeing that they were, I don't know what he saw, but he saw something, you know, in them. He totally saw the sort of empty, illusory nature of them. And they seemed to still be present, but he just saw right through them, which I just found that really inspiring as a sort of way of practicing. And I'll just finish with I just sort of think that all of these slogans, particularly, well, just any of them, for me, they're just a bit pointless unless they just feel like they can be techniques to make my, I can use them as techniques to make my life more comfortable, unless I'm looking at the wisdom aspect present, which is, you know, just to try and see the dreamlike nature of all phenomena and this sort of illusory nature of life. And if I'm in relation to that, within going for refuge, then I can be in relationship to these slogans. But if it's just the slogans, then it's just psychological. But it's, so for me, it needs this much bigger vision of the Dharma to be able to sort of do that, and then I can have a crack at it. Okay, thank you very much.